welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. I'm your host, Mike Allen. You know, solving murders was a lot more challenging in the years before police had all the sophisticated equipment they have today. Detectives had to use good old-fashioned ingenuity, powers of observation, and even interviewing skills. Well, today's story about the murder of George Holtz 100 years ago is really just such case. It was solved by a Connecticut State Police sergeant who went on to great things later in his career. Well, here to tell us all about this amazing story is Jack Sanders. Jack's a local historian in the greater Ridgefield area and the retired longtime editor of the Ridgefield Press newspaper. By any measure, he's a newspaperman's newspaperman. Jack will be along in just a moment. This week's trivia question, this was Benedict Arnold's last major engagement in Connecticut. What was it? Stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know the topic for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. When people need the best quality health care, there's a reason they turn to Yale New Haven Health. In 1826, Yale New Haven Hospital became Connecticut's very first hospital. They were the first hospital in the U.S. to use chemotherapy. Yale New Haven was the first to introduce insulin pumps for diabetic patients. And they introduced the world's first intensive care unit for newborns. For more information about Yale New Haven Health, visit YNHHS.org. That's YNHHS.org. The year was 1923. That's a little more than a century ago. It was a vicious and diabolical murder. It occurred in Ridgefield, Connecticut, and it was right near the border with Reading. That setting, most decidedly, quite rural. Despite the presence of the Danbury to Norwalk train line, which was put in the 1850s, this region was about as remote as you're going to get in central Fairfield County. It was beautiful, it's got sprawling farms, at least back then it did, a few gorgeous ponds, and local farmhands George Holtz and John Dandone. Now, both George and John worked on those sprawling local farms as part-time helpers, but there was a nearly 50-year age difference between them. George Holtz was in his 70s, and John Dandone, well, he was in his 20s. George Holtz was murdered on the evening of May 4th, 1923. The case, well, it stumped the local police and all the residents in the area alike for quite some time. That was until some good old-fashioned gumshoe detective work put the pieces of the puzzle together. It was indeed a challenge for Connecticut Police Sergeant John Kelly to figure all of it out, but he followed those time-tested methodologies of old for uncovering clues, and yes, he finally broke the case. One of the many twists and turns involves the age-old practice of picking dandelions in the early spring. That's not to declutter a manicured lawn, but rather for dinner. You're going to hear about the role the dandelion picking played in this rather sordid affair from our guest today, and that would be Jack Sanders. He's a noted Ridgefield historian and the retired longtime editor of the Ridgefield Press. Now, when you look at George Holtz, who was the deceased in this case, he's in his early 70s, he's divorced, he has a child, but he's working on a farm, and so is this guy who we're going to get into later, Dandone. If you could just spend a second telling us what it was like in those days for farmhands to be hired and work a farm in that section of town.
Most farms used temporary labor. They would hire seasonal help. And both of these people were seasonal help. There were two or three that knew them and used them for various tasks like plowing, clearing the fields, getting ready for planting, planting itself, and eventually weeding, harvesting, all that stuff.
Now, this murder occurs in May, early May, so they would have planted and, you know, things would have been set up for the season.
They would just be planting in May, because you're still very close to the end of the frost season, so they would have just been getting things into the ground.
This is also the time when dandelions are up, right?
Yes. That's the time to eat the greens. Once they get into June, July, the leaves get bigger, they get bitter, very bitter. It's the fresh leaves that come up very early in the spring that are the tastiest.
Tell us about Dandone and Holtz when they worked together. Holtz used to pick on him, didn't he?
Yes. They believe that he used to make fun of Dandone's Italian heritage, perhaps his accent. But Dandone came over here in 1918. He should have picked up a good deal of English by then, but he was living in much of the year in an Italian community where probably just Italian was spoken, so I don't know how good his English was. But Holtz was probably also a person who had an accent, because I think he's from Germany. And I don't know where he got off picking on the poor Italian accent, but anyway, he did, and there were witnesses to that told the police about it. So there was animosity.
Now let's get into the incident itself. So Dandone is walking along the train track saying that he's going to a field to get some dandelions. There's going to be a call made on the morning of May 5th to the local police. And local police in those days was the Connecticut State Police. And there was a new guy who was running the Ridgefield Barracks. Tell us what you can about that.
The state police had been founded in 1903, based in Hartford, with five men. Five men covered the entire state of Connecticut. For a long time, if you called and you needed their help, primarily with any kind of statewide laws that were fairly serious, if you called for help, they would have to take a train to get to you. This is before the cars were even popular. And the state police department didn't grow much until 1920, when Prohibition came. And then all these towns that basically had no police departments, they may have had a constable or two, all of a sudden had to enforce the ban on liquor. They couldn't do it. They didn't have the manpower. So all of a sudden, the state decided to greatly increase the size of the state police, and they set up local units. The first one they set up was Troop A in Ridgefield.
Now, there's a guy named John Kelly who's going to be in the Ridgefield Barracks as the commander, and he's in his 30s, and he had a pretty meteoric rise, didn't he, through the ranks?
He did. He's an example of what you might call a self-made cop, because he went into the Navy during World War I and was involved in submarine chasers. And after he got out, he joined what was then a state agency that policed motor vehicles. It was a motor vehicle patrol. It was not the state police. It was a motor vehicle patrol. They used motorcycles. Their aim was to crack down on these newfangled automobiles and unsafe equipment, unsafe practices, making sure they're registered. They were especially interested in trucks, which were quite dangerous back then. Meanwhile, Prohibition was adopted, and that was in 1920. That's just about the time that John Kelly had joined this motor vehicle patrol. But the state, with Prohibition, all of a sudden had all these new problems to deal with. Immediately, the old motor vehicle patrol that Kelly had been in was absorbed into the state police, and all of a sudden, Kelly was now a state policeman. Kelly was a sharp guy. This was all 1921-22. By 1923, he was a sergeant, and he was in charge of Troop A. Now that's, as you say, kind of a meteoric rise. Remember, too, that there was no state police academy back then. There were no training courses. There was no FBI school that they could go to. He was in charge of education for the entire Connecticut State Police as a side job. He was a sharp guy, very good instincts, and knew how to conduct an investigation.
So now, Dandone, Kelly had some great opportunities to try out some of his insights, because Dandone had some characteristics that people found kind of interesting, and Kelly did ultimately as well. First of all, he was a bit of a hothead. he was a bit of, I'll use the word swindler. I mean, he used to tell people he was a special cop during Prohibition and show up at speakeasies and shake them down for hush money so that he wouldn't tell his colleague. Right. And he's not even a policeman, and he's telling people this.
This is up in Danbury, yeah.
So he's got this side to him for sure. And then in the Italian-American community in Danbury, a woman had come over from Italy named Mary Mastriani, and he fell for her, and now he wanted to marry her. And Mary's brother got a little bit involved with this, shall we say, and kind of looked over the shoulder and said, I know you're interested, so where's the ring, right?
Yeah, and that's ultimately why all this happened, because this is a guy that's making $15 a week as a farmhand. A ring is going to cost, the ring he bought anyway, it was $100. That's a lot of money. So he had to find the money somewhere, and he knew that Hulse was in the habit of carrying $15 or $20 around with him all the time. So he knew that Hulse was a source of some money. Having little liking for the man, he decided, I'm going to get some money from him.
Now, George Hulse, the deceased again, he's living in a shack on some woman's property near one of the farms. And Dan Doan is living not too far away, you know, probably in a farm shelter of some sort. And on the evening of May 4th, now, Dan Doan is saying that he's walking down the train tracks because he's going to a field that has dandelions in it. Now, let's talk about then, just so we go step by step. So the morning of May 5th, Kelly gets this call, the cop. He meets with Dan Doan, of all people, shows up to show him around, and another guy, Albert Agner. Agner points out there's a vest on the side of the road with blood on it, but the main reason they got called was the shack that Hulse was living in had burned down overnight, but there was no body that they could find or whatnot. So how did Kelly go about figuring all this out?
Well, the bloody vest, certainly a clue that something was awry. And he looked at the remains of the shack. He found inside a shotgun, which had one shell in it that had been fired. So he suspected right away that maybe there was an assault involved. As it turned out, Dan Doan apparently struck Hulse over the head with an iron instrument, a logging tool, and killed him that way, not with the shotgun shell. That apparently went off during a struggle. So Kelly looked around the property and noticed that there was a spot where it looked like something had hit the ground. The ground was quite moist. There had been recent rain. Hit the ground and made an impression like somebody's head hitting hard. From that spot, he could see there was a trail through the grass of something being dragged. Well, pretty obvious what that might have been. He went all the way down across the road, across the railroad tracks to Umpawaug Pond, which was very close by. And near the spot where these drag marks led was a rowboat. And because of the differences in the way the dew settled on the seat of the boat, he could tell that it had, at least during the night, been used by someone. Someone's rear end had sat on that seat. And so he suspected that the body was put out into the water and probably weighted down. He called for people that were expert in dragging for underwater bodies, and they couldn't find anything. And then he asked for volunteers from a Newtown police group that they were used to going for bodies that were in the Housatonic River. And after a short while, they found Hulse's body.
Now, wasn't there something unusual about the body? I mean, it's not like he drowned, right? What did they find about the body?
There was no evidence that he had actually drowned because there was no water in his lungs. There was no sign that he had been drinking. There's no alcohol in his stomach. And there were also, I'm pretty sure, wound marks on his head. So it was evident that he had been thrown in the water and not accidentally drowned. But how did they know that it was Dan Doan?
Didn't Dan Doan tell him that he was walking along the tracks when he heard the gun go off?
When Kelly started questioning him, because he had heard some things that Dan Doan had been seen in the area before the fire, he started questioning him. And Dan Doan admitted that, well, yeah, I was walking along and Holtz came out on his front porch with a shotgun and he aimed it at me and he shot at me. Thought I was picking dandelions on his property or in his territory. So Dan Doan tells Kelly he went after Holtz for shooting at him. Now, Kelly immediately wondered about that, because if somebody's shooting at you, you usually go the opposite way. You hide. But Dan Doan said he ran toward Holtz, tackled him, got in a fight with him inside the house. They fought, knocked over the stove, which allegedly started the fire. He basically was saying that it was self-defense. He went after Holtz for shooting at him.
And didn't he more or less back Dan Doan into having to tell him this because he had figured out that Dan Doan didn't have the money to buy that ring? He was telling people he had $7,000 in the bank, but Kelly found out that he was borrowing money from friends at the same time. So he took him down to the morgue. He showed him Holtz's body, saw the reaction, which was too cool for Kelly's blood, and he then confronted him with, well, then where did you get the money for the ring? And then he blurted out this whole self-defense thing, right?
Yeah. He said, yes, I took the money, but the guy was dead, so he didn't need it. And I had every right to kill him because he was trying to kill me. But all of this just didn't strike Kelly the right way. He wouldn't go for it. He spent time up in Danbury talking to people and finding out about this pressure on Dan Doan to get a ring and to find money. He was telling his friends, people up in Danbury, that he was an undercover cop and that he knew more about what was going on than the people who were investigating it. I mean, when Kelly heard that, I'm sure he was just raised all the more of his hackles. He knew there was something wrong.
Now, Kelly then charges him, arrests him, takes him to court, and Dan Doan ends up pleading guilty, right?
Yes, to a reduced charge of manslaughter. He got 11 years. When he got out, they deported him back to Italy.
And what happened to John Kelly after this?
Well, John Kelly rose through the ranks of the Connecticut State Police. He became second in command for a long time, the executive officer in the 50s. And in 53, he was named commissioner, which is the same as chief of the entire Connecticut State Police. And he held that job for 2 years, and he might have held it longer, except that commissioner is a political appointee, and by 1955, Abraham Ribicoff, a Democrat, was the governor, and Ribicoff decided not to reappoint a Republican. So after that, John Kelly became a state representative and worked on a lot of committees that were involved in helping the state police or supporting the state police. He also served on the Liquor Control Commission, which is interesting because you remember that the reason the state police expanded, the reason John Kelly got into the state police, the reason Troop A was set up in Ridgefield was because of prohibition and alcohol. So later in life, he was chairman of the Connecticut Alcoholic Beverage Commission.
As Jack sees it, the murder occurred both because of John Dan Doan's love of a woman as well as his hatred for his farmhand co-worker. That wraps wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. You know, Commissioner Kelly was involved in a lot of fascinating cases over his storied career, but he always called the George Holtz murder his most interesting one. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Jack Sanders. He's a local historian in the greater Ridgefield area and the retired longtime editor of the Ridgefield Press newspaper. The answer to this week's trivia question, well, that question was, it was Benedict Arnold's last major engagement in Connecticut. What was it? The answer, the Battle of Groton Heights. And that's where both Groton and New London were raided by the British in a fierce and deadly encounter. Next week on Amazing Tales CT, we're going to focus on this incursion, which came very late in the Revolutionary War, and it saw one of the more brutal atrocities of the war occur there. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe, and please stay healthy.